Vitamins are organic molecules that we need to survive. You do not need a lot of them, but if you go without them for too long, then deficiencies result, and then you're going to be in for a bad time. Science helped us discover the magical life-saving properties of these vitamins. Engineering helped us scale and bring them everywhere. And cartels helped a few shadowy companies monopolize them for profit. This really happened. In this video, we look at vitamins and the secret international cabal manipulating their prices for almost a decade. But first, I want to remind you about the Asianometry Patreon. Early access members get to see new videos first. I deeply appreciate your feedback and support. Thank you, and on with the show. It has been known since ancient history that you must eat certain foods to stay healthy and alive. For example, the ancient Egyptians knew that you had to eat liver, which holds vitamin A, to stave off a generally unwanted condition known as night blindness. One of the foundational theoretical texts of Chinese medicine is the Inner Canon of the Yellow Emperor. One of its texts, the Su Wen, made a reference to a disease bearing similarities to a condition now called beriberi. The document was claimed to be written in 2697 BC by the mythical Yellow Emperor. It probably wasn't, but it was still very old. In the 110 to 130 AD era, a doctor in Rome named Serrano of Ephesus described an infant suffering a disease that we might think to be rickets. Most famously, in 1747, James Lund discovered that adding lime or lemon juice to the daily rations staved off a famous condition known as scurvy, ergo the name limeys. In those days, though, we had no idea what the preventive nutrient inside the food actually was. In the 1890s, a Dutch physician named Christian Eijkman was sent to what is now Indonesia to study the aforementioned beriberi disease. Searching for what he assumed to be a microbe, Eijkman noticed that he could induce in chickens a disease similar to beriberi by feeding them only polished rice, as in rice without the bran on it. But if you then fed the chickens unpolished rice, as in rice with the bran, they recovered. In 1906, Sir Frederick Hopkins theorized in unpublished lectures about, quote, accessory food factors, end quote, and the scientific community began to coalesce on the idea that something was essential to health, something not a carbohydrate, fat, protein, or mineral. In 1912, Hopkins published the results of several animal experiments showing that milk had something special in it that the animal could not themselves produce and needed for growth. Taking in all of this research, the Polish-American biochemist Casimir Funk claimed to have isolated Christian's anti-beriberi agent from the rice bran. This turned out to be incorrect. Funk had isolated vitamin B3, while the actual thing was vitamin B1. He dubbed this thing Vitae Amina, or Vitamina, recalling that the phrase sounded well and could serve as a catchword. As more vitaminas were discovered, it became clear that not all of them were amines, which had hydrogen. So someone suggested dropping the E to make it a more general term. One by one, the vitamins we know and love were discovered and isolated. Vitamin A and a few of the B vitamins, there are more than one, in the 1910s. Then from 1920 to 1950, vitamin C, D, E, K, and several more of the B vitamins. The last vitamin to be discovered was vitamin B12, isolated and named in 1948. Six Nobel winners contributed to its discovery and description. This was largely done with tests on laboratory rats and guinea pigs. Researchers fed a healthy diet to young growing animals and then systematically removed certain elements. Whether the animal gained or lost weight determined which foods potentially had a vitamin. They were giving out Nobels left and right for vitamin research in those days, and rightfully so, because the discovery of the importance of vitamins stands with water purification, vaccination, smoking cessation, and insect control as a landmark life-saving public health measure. For instance, the discovery of vitamin B12 helped alleviate a condition known as pernicious anemia, which afflicted 1 of every 1,000 people and, prior to 1926, was untreatable. The first vitamins were extracted out of natural substances like cod livers, but issues with the supply incentivized the search for methods to chemically synthesize vitamins, as in starting with a substance and then transforming it into the vitamin using a very particular set of skills, skills acquired over a very long career. Like in the case of my personal favorite vitamin, because we should all have one, vitamin C, and its ingenious hybrid chemical and fermentation method, the Reichstein process. The Reichstein process is a 7-step process. It starts by turning glucose into a sugar alcohol called sorbitol. We then employ a microbe to ferment the sorbitol into another chemical called sorbose. From there, we convert the sorbose into KLG acid, and then we then convert the KLG acid molecule into a ring format to get vitamin C. The ingenious bacteria fermentation step lets us avoid having to do more complicated processes to maintain the correct oriented isomers. By the end of the 1930s, large-scale production processes had been discovered for vitamins E, C, B1, B2, B3, and B4. One of the last to be industrialized was the fat-soluble vitamin A, which entered high-volume production in 1947. One of the biggest beneficiaries of this industrialization was the Swiss company Hoffmann La Roche, or just Roche, in the city of Basel, Switzerland. In just a few decades, Roche became the world's leading vitamin supplier. Founded in the late 1980s by Fritz Hoffmann as a factory for salves and other medical remedies, they entered the hormone and vitamin extraction businesses. Hormones were promising, but a shortage of sufficient animal organs in the late 1920s caused them to pivot to vitamins. In 1933, Roche licensed the aforementioned Reichstein process. Tadas Reichstein was then an assistant at the Swiss Institute of Technology, coming up with the process while working on other things. It wasn't the first such process, and Roche already had their own in the lab, but Reichstein's was ingenious, and the yields looked much better. So Roche licensed it and started selling vitamin C to the market, expecting this niche biochemical to sell at most maybe 10 kilograms a year. But it turned into a massive, unexpected success, the ChatGPT of vitamins, and kicked off Roche's full-scale pivot into vitamin production. After vitamin C, Roche ramped up vitamin B1 in 1936, B2 in 1937, E in 1938, and many others. Factories around the world were set up to supply vitamins for consumption and industry. By 1939, they were the world's leading maker of vitamins B, C, and E, and it provided the majority of their revenues. Roche maintained a monopoly position in each of its vitamins for an average of 2 decades, but in the 1960s, competition from other European countries and Japan joined the fray. To go back to an earlier example, vitamin A. In the late 1960s, BASF, a chemical company based in Germany, muscled into the market. BASF once made supplemental vitamin A acetate for Roche, but went rogue, selling their own animal-grade vitamin A. Since then, Roche and BASF shared the market. Then came the French chemical company Rhône-Poulenc, or RP, which produced A, E, D3, and B12 sometime before the 1980s. Roche, BASF, and RP thus make up the big three in European vitamin production. The Japanese entered the market in the late 1950s and 1960s as patents expired. Takeda is the leader, the first Japanese to produce multivitamins in 1950 and export vitamin C into the United States in 1955. By the 1990s, they had significant share of the C, B1, B6, and B9 folic acid markets. Other major Japanese producers are Eisai and Daiichi. Like Takeda, they held significant shares of specific vitamin markets. On the whole, about 30% of the world's vitamin production is for human supplements. These percentages do fluctuate based on the vitamin and even the vitamin subtype. For example, 92% of vitamin C production is for human consumption, while 73% of vitamin E and A are for animals. Other vitamin uses include fortified human food or animal feeds. For example, Unilever used Roche's artificial vitamin A to fortify their margarine, replacing the previously used whale liver oil. I'm sure the whales and vegetarians appreciated that. The chemical processes to make these vitamins are very mature. However, the technologies behind them are trade secrets, and the necessary chemical intermediaries are not generally available on the open market. And several of the vitamins have synergies of scale. Firms producing several of these vitamins hold cost advantages over firms selling just one. So an aspiring new competitor either has to establish a relationship with an existing supplier, who might not be inclined to endanger the relationship with Roche or BASF, or they invest considerably more money than it is worth to develop that expertise and capacity across multiple vitamins. And the market value of the vitamins pie is not that big, about $3 to $4 billion a year throughout the 1990s. These technical barriers to entry are perhaps most formidable with the oil-soluble vitamins A, D, E, and the water-soluble B3. Yet at the same time, these are all commodities. There is no difference between two suppliers of a particular vitamin other than wholesale price and maybe purity. Finally, let us take a look at the market players. On the supplier side, you have an industry that, since the Japanese entry in the 1970s, has been largely static with little entry or exit. Going into the 1980s, the big three of Roche, BASF, and RP held 60% of overall world production, and within each of the vitamin markets, three to five companies control 95% of total capacity. And the buyers tend to be quite small and don't buy a lot each year. Farmers, cooperatives, mixers, and product food companies. Even the largest buyers, like Coca-Cola, might make up just over 2% of the market. So commodity products, high technical barriers to entry with little manufacturing innovations in decades, many small buyers, consolidated, very static suppliers, ingredients for a stew of cartelization. Now, Roche has some history of its activities in the vitamins market. In 1973, a longtime Maltese-born executive in the Roche vitamin department named Stanley Adams resigned and moved to London. Disgruntled after being turned down for a role in Mexico, he started passing documents of vitamin contracts to the European Commission. The contracts revealed customer loyalty rebates that violated European law. Roche stopped that and was fined 140,000 British pounds. But the EC investigation also tipped Roche off to the fact that Adams passed over confidential documents, which was illegal in Swiss law, and had him arrested and jailed. This escalated things in such a way that Roche probably did not anticipate, and the quote-unquote Adams affair, as it was called, dragged on for years. His wife later hung herself after told he could be jailed for 20 years, and the Swiss refused to let him attend her funeral. Adams fled Italy on bail and settled in England. In 1984, he wrote a book titled Roche vs. Adams, in which he accused Roche of conspiring to fix the world vitamin market. Quote, "Meetings were held, often in Basel. The manufacturers discussed world prices for different vitamins and chemicals and set a price which they all agreed to keep," end quote. Such allegations were never proven, and Adams' story later takes a dark turn. In 1994, he was jailed for 10 years for plotting to have his wife murdered for a £500,000 insurance payout. He served 5 years. Per the evidence, the vitamin cartels began in the late 1980s. The 1980s were brutal for Roche and the Europeans. Japan's Eisai had entered the vitamin E market and France's RP the vitamin A market. The competition had caused prices for both vitamins to fall dramatically, putting pressure on both companies. Something had to be done, and Roche took the lead in making it happen. In June 7, 1989, vitamin executives at Roche and BASF held a top-level meeting in Basel. Then in August 1989, a second meeting in Zurich that included executives from RP. They met again in September, with the chairman and heads of the vitamin divisions all present. The meetings discussed cooperation in the vitamin A and E markets. They would freeze their 1988 market shares and divide the future markets amongst themselves using a sales quota. The whole thing was referred to as the budget and tracked with spreadsheets and databases. The cartel's underlying principle was price before volume. Starting in 1990, the companies slowly raised the prices of their vitamins A and E to pre-discussed levels. Several animal feed companies asked why the price increases, but were told it was due to quote-unquote exchange rates or cost increases. In the second half of 1990, Roche recruited Eisai, the final significant vitamin E maker, allocating them 1,600 tons of the market. Eisai agreed only if they can see everyone else's sales data. A complicated set of regular meetings developed between the companies at various levels to ensure that all the participants stuck to the deal. And when someone was suspected of cheating, like Daiichi was thought to be in 1993, Roche and Takeda punished them with their own price cuts. The success of the vitamin A and E cartels motivated the cartelization of the other vitamins. Other companies were recruited, getting Takeda and Daiichi let Roche's cartel take over 45 to 60% of the vitamins B1, B6, and B9 folic acid markets. Adding the Japanese also let Roche set up a separate cartel to coordinate the vitamin C, B2, B5, and beta carotene markets, though these markets were nowhere near as top-heavy as the A and E markets. Notably, they were challenged by Chinese exporters. Though seen by consumers as fringe producers of lesser quality at the start, the various Chinese players, there was no single major player, were government-subsidized and extremely eager to expand. When the cartel tried to raise prices, the Chinese ate W's. In 1991, the vitamin B1 cartel tried to raise prices from below 65 Deutschmark to 74 or 76 Deutschmarks, but the Chinese surged and the cartel members argued over how to respond. In June 1993, the cartel agreed to price match only certain customers using Chinese products, but this nonsensical dual price structure failed to hold, and in June 1994, the cartel members agreed to dissolve the agreement. A somewhat different tale unfolded for the vitamin C cartel. Roche, BASF, Takeda, and the German firm E. Merck, descended from but not related to the American Merck, but with a similar ending. Vitamin C is a very large market with many more players and a massive technical disruption. In the 1970s, the Institute of Microbiology of the Chinese Academy of Sciences and the Beijing Pharmaceutical Factory discovered a breakthrough two-step vitamin C process. If you recall, the old trusty Reichstein process turns glucose into sorbitol into sorbose via microbe fermentation into KLG acid into vitamin C. The Chinese two-step process greatly simplifies these chemical steps by fermenting a pair of bacteria that work together to directly produce KLG acid that we can then turn into vitamin C. This skips a great deal of energy-intensive and chemically dodgy steps. Vitamin C producers in China use this revolutionary two-step process to produce at incredible scale and low prices throughout the 1980s, but restrictive Chinese government policies kept all of this supply internal. That all changed in the 1990s with Deng Xiaoping's economic liberalization policies. By 1995, 20-plus Chinese state-owned firms had stampeded into the global vitamin C market, taking 20% market share and collapsing the cartel. So several of the vitamin cartels had collapsed naturally under the weight of the Chinese newcomers, but a few others survived until they were finally discovered by the authorities. The cartels feared discovery by the Americans and avoided meeting on U.S. soil, but by 1990, the success of the vitamin A and E cartels motivated Roche to try other markets, namely citric acid. The citric acid price-fixing conspiracy looped in Jung Bunzlauer of Germany, Bayer of Germany, and Archer Daniels Midland, or ADM, of the United States. The behavior then metastasized out of ADM's citric acid division into lysine, an animal food additive. In 1992, an ADM division president named Mark Whitaker went to the FBI because his wife threatened to do so herself if he didn't. Whitaker wore a wire to meetings and cracked the case. In 1996, ADM paid $100 million for the wrongdoing. Investigators traced the cartelizing behavior from ADM to Roche. When questioned about it in 1997, Roche's head of marketing lied and denied the allegations. BASF and RP said the same thing. But the evidence was mounting, particularly in the B3 vitamin cartel, which had a few smaller manufacturers. The feds put pressure on those guys, and they crumbled like a fortune cookie, got them talking about their participation in the cartels. Once they had that evidence, they turned to the big three. The breakthrough was in late 1998 when RP agreed to talk. Why RP cracked is not entirely clear. It might have had something to do with RP wanting antitrust approval for its $22 billion merger with Roche, but their cooperation sealed the deal. The feds went to Roche and BASF with RP's evidence and testimony, and they quickly caved too. In exchange for lower fees, they agreed to cooperate. In May 1999, the news came out that firms would be fined $1 billion for their actions. The European Commission had no idea of the cartel's actions until then. Roche paid the highest fee, $500 million. A Roche spokesperson said in 1999, "We can't dispute the facts, and we've decided it is of no value to unravel it. The situation is behind us, and we've paid dearly for it." We have largely forgotten about the vitamin cartels today, and even while they were going on, I feel like most consumers might not have even noticed. That is because the parties most affected were companies. Consumers already get marked up a lot on their retail vitamins. Assuming a 30% markup, they were overcharged about 1%. On their purchases throughout the cartel's entire existence. But the cartel did have long-lasting effects on the industry. Roche sold off their vitamins division to another Swiss company, DSM. BASF recently announced that they were selling part of their human nutrition division to Louis Dreyfus. I think most of all, the cartel's end marked the rise of Chinese dominance in food material supply, especially in the specialty goods import market. A concern that we perhaps should pay more attention to in the coming days. Alright everyone, that's it for tonight. Thanks for watching. Subscribe to the channel, sign up for the Patreon, and I'll see you guys next time.